broadcasting around the world on International Shortwave and on the Radio Disclosure Radio Network. I'm your host tonight, Matt Aaron. I bid you good evening, good morning, wherever you may be in our universe. Tonight, we're going to hit on a subject that we've talked about it before here on Radio Disclosure, but we're going to come back to it. Mothman. There's a Mothman festival. There's all kinds of things surrounding Mothman. And what's crazy about this is all the documents, all the research. We're going to talk to Bill Kusla tonight, and he's going to tell us about his research. He's applied psychology. He has a PhD. He's not just, you know, hey, a fly-by-night guy. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program. And why don't you introduce yourself to the audience? Tell them a little bit about yourself, where you're from, what got you into this insanity paranormal research.
Well, good evening, Matt. Hey, thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it. I guess for me, the Mothman Prophecies movie kicked it all off. In 2002, I saw it. It really grabbed me. And I didn't realize until the very end of the movie that it was based upon some factual things that took place in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, back in 1966 and 67. So the next few years, I began reading and researching everything I could get my hands on that spoke to the Mothman Prophecies, certainly with John Keel's book, The Mothman Prophecies, that came out in 75. And read that and read a bunch of other stuff that's been published since then about the phenomenon, and just really have become a frequent flyer in the Point Pleasant, West Virginia area over the last 5 years. Completed my doctorate in psychology earlier this year, and we have a project currently going on. My wife and I and our fellow researcher, Amanda Raber, we have a project going on to investigate the post-traumatic growth that took place from people who experienced not only Mothman, but the Silver Bridge collapse 1967 in Point Pleasant, West Virginia.
So you're using psychology to get more into what happened here. Talk about phenomenon. Just amazing. Okay. So let's back up for a second. So you saw this movie, and for those that don't know what the movie is, it's a movie about Mothman, but which you didn't know when you watched it at first, I guess is what you just said, is you didn't know that it was based upon something true. And now that you know that, you decided to do some research on it. Okay. I'm trying to zoom out here a little bit and figure out where I want to poke this bear. What is Mothman? That, I think, is the first question for anybody that's just tuning in that's never heard of Mothman. What is Mothman? Let's start there.
And that's a great question, because I think Mothman is different to different people. And I would say that in the traditional sense, Mothman was the name that was given to an alleged creature that manifested in Point Pleasant, West Virginia in 1966 and 67. This was a flying, winged, black thing with red piercing eyes. And the first that it was really seen in the Point Pleasant area, there were a couple of young married couples that were in 57 Chevy in an area called the TNT area, just north of Point Pleasant, about 11 miles, that they were just kind of cruising around, hanging out, and all of a sudden they saw this black winged thing that scared them half to death. They raced all the way back into town. It followed them at up to 100 miles an hour. And basically, you know, they stopped into the police department and gave their report. And they were kids that were really well known throughout the community, not as troublemakers, but as good, upstanding young people. And so they were very believable. But this particular creature manifested to different people over the course of the next 13 months in the Point Pleasant area. And Most folks saw it as this winged thing that I just described. Others saw it as a bird. In fact, they referred to it in Point Pleasant as the Big Bird, not necessarily Mothman. The name Mothman was given to the creature by the media.
Interesting. So as this entity was chasing people, doing things to people, all of that, is it considered dangerous? Is it considered not dangerous?
The interesting thing about Mothman, per se, was that it never physically caused anybody harm. It never hurt anyone. It scared people. I mean, people were terrified by it. It's something that would typically manifest at night. There were a couple of daytime appearances of Mothman as well, but it never physically hurt anybody. It scared them. Some of them remained traumatized emotionally for the rest of their lives, but it never physically harmed anyone.
Interesting. Okay, so your research, let's take a deep dive into that. What, explain your research, what it is that you're doing, and yeah.
So basically, let me go back a few years, Matt. Back in 2016, my wife, Jackie, said, hey, we need to go on a vacation. We haven't been anywhere for a while. What would you like to do? Where would you like to go? And so I just said, you know, I've been studying this Mothman thing. She'd heard me talking about it for 10 years. And I said, let's go to Point Pleasant. So we took a road trip to Point Pleasant, West Virginia in July of 2016. And when we arrived in town, we got there. It was a Friday night. And we wanted to go to the Mothman Museum. There's a museum in Point Pleasant that has all types of memorabilia, T-shirts, souvenirs, all kinds of newspaper clippings and things from the movie itself that Jeff Wamsley, the owner of the Mothman Museum, has throughout this really cool place. But it was closed. So we just kind of hung out, didn't really know what to do. And we saw a little old lady who was in a restaurant just across the street from the museum. And Jackie said to me, she said, I think she wants us to come in. I think she wants to talk to us. So we decided to go into her restaurant, and we got to visiting with her. Turns out her name was Carolyn Harris. She owned the Mothman Diner, also known as the Harris Steakhouse. And she had been in business for many, many years. And she had actually lost her son and her ex-husband in the Silver Bridge collapse of 1967. So this lady had built a business and welcomed strangers like us and anybody else into the town and just treated us so kindly. We just fell in love with this lady. So we were there for just a few days. We visited with her every single day. And then we left and came back home after our vacation was over. And a few months later, I told my wife, I said, you know what? I really think we need to get a hold of Carolyn. She had given us her phone numbers. And I said, I need to write something about her. I would love to see if she'd tell me her story. I would love to write a book about her. So this was actually on Christmas Eve of 2016. And that day, or the day after, Carolyn had a heart attack, and the next day she died.
Oh, dear.
And so we were crushed. We just loved this lady. We had finally come up with a plan to get back a hold of her. We wanted to write her story, and it wasn't going to happen, and we knew it was never going to happen. So it was really pretty heartbreaking for us. But to fast forward to today, back several months ago, when I finished my doctorate, I had studied the phenomenon of post-traumatic growth, which is basically the good stuff that comes from the bad things that we go through in life. It could be a natural disaster. It could be a disease or the death of a loved one or something that happens that's just totally outside of our experience. And how do you deal with those things? I mean, we all have to. But then I got to thinking about this Silver Bridge collapse, and I thought about Carolyn. And we thought, you know, what better way to pay a tribute to this lady who we only knew for a very short period of time but made such an impression on us, to put together a study that allows me to be able to use my background now as a researcher to combine our experience of getting to know this lady with my passion for the whole Mothman phenomenon and come up with a story basically of these people in Point Pleasant who had endured this horrible thing that happened, but good things have come from. And let's put a study together about that. So basically what we've done, Matt, is we've conducted interviews so far with 9 different individuals from the Point Pleasant area, extending up into the Charleston area. And we've had the opportunity to interview a number of folks who are pretty key to the whole Mothman story, as well as some who are lesser known but had wonderful stories and great experiences. And we're processing this according to psychological theory, and we're utilizing a qualitative measure. So we're not really using statistics. We're using their personal stories to be able to come up with the elements of post-traumatic growth that they were able to grow and build and experience as a result of going through this horrible catastrophic disaster and this supernatural thing that's happened as well. So in a nutshell, that's the project.
So Bill, I guess one of the things that we're going to have to discuss here is this bridge collapse. What is the bridge collapse? When did it happen? I think you said 1965. And what does Mothman have to do with this bridge collapse? That's where I'd like to kind of start and then deep dive into your data. 1-833-880-9899 if you want to join us. They called him Birdman. Big Bird. Not Mothman. See? I mean, the media, yeah, just gave the guy the name, or gave Mothman his name. All right. We'll be back. This is Radio Disclosure. Welcome back to Radio Disclosure. 1-833-880-9899. Bill Kuslis, I think I said your name right.
It sounded close enough.
Welcome back to the show. So this bridge collapse that happened in this city, in this town. We were trying to go over this, trying to understand it. Trying to know what the actual story is. Can you enlighten us a little?
So the Silver Bridge was built in 1928, and it was an engineering marvel for 1928. It was assembled as a two-lane bridge. No four lanes existed at that point in time, but it was set up originally as a toll bridge with a toll booth on the Ohio side. So it handled the traffic of 1920s, 1930s, 1940s really pretty well. But as we started having more over-the-road semi-trucks and vehicles got to be heavier and heavier, the bridge took a pounding. And basically, by the time 1967 rolled around, it was pretty rickety. And we had the opportunity to interview some folks that gave us some pretty good descriptions of just what kind of repair the bridge was in 1966. There's a gentleman by the name of Denny Bellamy, who is the director of the Mason County Visitors Bureau in Point Pleasant. And in our conversation with Denny, he had shared with us that he was a little kid, 7, 8 years old, when the bridge collapse happened in 67. And he had memories of he and his sister, who was a little older than him, walking across the bridge. She would literally grab him by his arm, swing him over holes that were in the bridge so that he wouldn't fall through and into the river. So it was pretty beat up. We had another lady who we interviewed who also told us that she was on the bridge the night before it collapsed and said she could feel it groaning. And she mentioned to the young lady who was in the car with her, they were 17 years old at the time, she said, "This bridge is going to collapse." And her friend said, "You're crazy. That bridge is never going to go down." But unfortunately, that was pretty prophetic, because the next day, December 15th of 1967, at 5 o'clock, the bridge was packed. It was packed with people just getting off work, you know, heading both directions from West Virginia to Ohio and from Ohio back to West Virginia. And people were Christmas shopping and such. The bridge was just totally packed. And the lights on both ends of the bridge were red. So apparently the bridge experienced that type of thing pretty frequently. So the bridge was totally loaded up. And according to some of the other folks that we interviewed, they could hear the bridge collapse from their homes nearby. And it sounded as though there were a bomb that blew up. And basically the way it was described was that the bridge turned on its right and then turned on its left and just dumped cars off into the river, and all the debris collapsed on top of the folks that were below. There were very few survivors. And in the end result, there were 46 people who lost their lives in the collapse.
That's very tragic. But what did Mothman have to do with this?
That really depends upon who you ask the question to, because there are people who claim that Mothman was seen on the bridge the day before it went down. There are people who say that Mothman was seen in the area right around the time the bridge went down. And then there is a large majority of people that didn't experience Mothman at all. So, you know, I don't personally think that Mothman was responsible for the bridge collapsing. And according to the people that I've had the opportunity to talk to and the general consensus that I've been able to come up with has been that Mothman didn't have anything to do with the bridge collapse. If anything, Mothman may have been some type of a harbinger of doom, basically warning individuals that there was something going on in the community, something bad was about to happen, and perhaps prophesized disaster just by being there. Because after the bridge collapsed, there were no reports of Mothman for a very substantial period of time afterwards.
Interesting. So has there been other instances of where Mothman is present prior to day before, hours before something tragic happens?
I have heard various reports, some of which could very well be urban legend, that there were sightings of Mothman prior to something else terrible happening. You know, I know the I-35 bridge that collapsed in Minnesota, that I have heard some rumblings that perhaps there was some type of a sighting in the vicinity of when that happened. But I've also heard some people push back pretty hard that were there that said that nothing like that happened whatsoever. There's also another piece of urban legend that probably came from the Mothman Prophecies movie, that in Chernobyl, Ukraine, when the nuclear reactor exploded, that there were sightings of a Mothman type creature. But even the gentleman who was really involved with the screenwriting of the Mothman Prophecies movie, Richard Haddam, stated that he thinks he's responsible for that coming out as urban legend, because it was mentioned within the movie, The Mothman Prophecies. There have been other sightings, alleged sightings, in different areas where things have happened, but really kind of hard to substantiate. I mean, really the epicenter, from what I've been able to pick up, where there was a real tangible type of correlation between Mothman appearances and a disaster happening, would have been in Point Pleasant.
Okay. I guess I'm trying to figure out the correlation of why Mothman would be on site prior to the bridge falling. But at the same time, it's well documented at this point that the bridge did fall due to lack of maintenance, due to all of those things, human neglect, not supernatural instances.
And even design failure, Matt, because, I mean, really, Ibar number 13 had a design flaw in which it was cracked. There was a hairline fracture that was in that particular Ibar. Mm-hmm. And when the bridge did go down and the Army Corps of Engineers reassembled the bridge, they were able to identify that that was the cause of it. So, yeah, I mean, did a supernatural occurrence happen to take the bridge down? I don't think that was the case, personally.
Interesting. So the people that went through this experience, and you're talking about using your PhD in trying to figure out this whole entire thing and the experience and so on and so forth, walk us through that again. We went through that before. Now that we understand the whole bridge collapse and Mothman, his game or the part of the role that he played in that, How does your research go about understanding that whole side of it?
So basically, the way that we put the program together was we approached it as though we were writing a psychological article along the format of what a dissertation looks like. So we came up with a couple of research questions. And the first research question was, what are the dimensions of post-traumatic growth that were experienced by people who endured the Silver Bridge collapse? The second research question was very similar, but it was, what are the dimensions of post-traumatic growth that were experienced by people who also encountered paranormal phenomena in the area of Point Pleasant, West Virginia? Mm-hmm. So we put these questions together and we used kind of an if-then type of a format, because not everybody that we interviewed, in fact, the majority of the people who we interviewed so far had not experienced any tangible Mothman or paranormal phenomena in their experience of what happened in 1967. Most of them, all of them, did experience some type of effects of the Silver Bridge collapse. So we were able to use that if-then proposition, and if they did experience the paranormal phenomena, we would go into the second series of questions, and we basically utilized open-ended conversational questions, just like you and I are talking. And we didn't have anything other than guiding questions such as, tell us what your life was like before the Silver Bridge disaster. And we had people that were anywhere from 7 years old up to 20, 21 years old that when the bridge collapsed. So we had, you know, various ranges of experiences based upon the age the people were at the time. So we went through our series of questions. We went into what was the immediate experience? What was the immediate effect of the bridge collapse? And so we got some really good responses about, you know, the way people felt and what they endured and the different things that kind of emerged from the study. After we collected all the data from the interviews we've done so far, which are 9, we have one more that we still have to do. But after we did that, I have to go through a series of basically interpreting that data. So line by line, we had every one of the interviews. They were done video and audio, but we had them all transcribed. And Amanda did most of the transcription there. My wife, Jackie, did some of the transcripts as well. Put all that together, and then I had to load all of the transcripts into a software called Atlas TI. In Atlas TI, I have to go through a process of coding that information. What that means is I take line by line what everybody said and analyze if there were any particular meaning units that came from their statements. And pretty much every line had something substantial in it. Next, we began coding the data and getting basic themes, and then moved it over into greater themes from that point forward.
Interesting. When we come back from the break, I want to ask how much paranormal activity took place during the Silver Bridge disaster. That's the question that's in the back of my head right now, especially with the people that you interviewed. Lot of information. 1-833-880-9899. We'll be back. This is Radio Disclosure. Welcome back to Radio Disclosure. 1-833-880-9899 is the number. Bill Kuslis. I think I said your name right. Hopefully I did.
You nailed it.
Welcome back to the show. You have a website. How can people find you online?
2 different ways that you can do that. The website is phenomenologyresearchpartners.com, all one word. Again, phenomenologyresearchpartners.com. We also have a Facebook site with the same name, phenomenologyresearchpartners.com, and I have a Facebook profile, Bill Kuslis.
So, okay, getting back into the main part here, how much paranormal activity surrounded the Silver Bridge and the towns surrounding it, etc.?
the paranormal activity that took place within the community and the greater, let's say, 50 to 60 mile radius of Point Pleasant, West Virginia, was absolutely off the charts. And if you can kind of reframe Point Pleasant into maybe a context similar to what Skinwalker Ranch was all about, where all different types of things were going on, that's very, very similar to what was happening in the West Virginia and Ohio River Valley area in 66 and 67. In fact, the first thing that took place was when Mothman was sighted, even before the two young couples, the Scarberries and the Millettes, were chased by Mothman from the TNT area. There was actually a manifestation of a winged creature that three gravediggers saw in Clendenin, West Virginia, which is about 50, 60 miles up the road from Point Pleasant. But anything from the winged creature that we've already discussed, the big bird, what have you, UFOs, purple lights in the sky, men in black activity, cattle mutilations, a dog went, it was disappeared, Indrid Cold, for those who are familiar with the whole Mothman mythos, Indrid Cold was an alleged spaceman who appeared to a gentleman by the name of Woody Derenberger in the Parkersburg, West Virginia area during the same time frame too, claimed to be from a different planet. I mean, you name it. There was all kinds of crazy stuff going on. So specific to the Silver Bridge collapse, that part of it, I mean, were the timelines just coincidental? That's entirely possible. But for the 13 months prior to the bridge collapse, there was all kinds of paranormal phenomena that was taking place in that area.
Okay. So here's, you just unloaded on me. Okay. So after the bridge collapsed, did the paranormal activity slow down, stop, or pretty much cease to exist for a while? Because we know that there's still stuff going on today, but what happened in that sense?
So the way that Jeff Wamsley, who owns the Mothman Museum, has discussed this over the years, is that when the bridge collapse happened, and even Denny Bellamy said the same thing, nobody wanted to talk about all that quote unquote nonsense anymore because the town, yeah, I mean, and I, that, those aren't my words. Those are folks who experienced its words. I mean, to me, it's just a tremendous story. But I mean, if you put yourself in the position of the folks who actually dealt with the bridge collapse and the deaths and the losses and all the things that they endured, I can totally understand why they didn't want to combine the whole Mothman thing with the bridge collapse. Now, basically, everybody focused on the aftermath of the bridge collapse. So whether or not the actual paranormal phenomena stopped entirely, or maybe it was a combination of it stopping and people focusing on something else, or maybe it just totally did go away at that point in time, the way that it's been written about by John Keel, the way that it's been spoken about by prominent members of the town of Point Pleasant and around, that activity stopped and didn't come back for quite some time.
All right. So you mentioned something just momentarily ago, and you just flew by it, and that was Men in Black. And because of the movie, the stuff around it now since the movie, which makes it more cliche when you talk about it, especially like on a show like this, like, you know, oh, the Men in Black. I guess, like, okay, what does that mean when you say that? I mean, are we talking about, you know, Will Smith walking around with his little flashy thing and I'm going to erase your memory, or are we talking about legitimate trying to cover up things here? What, I mean, and again, this is 1965 we're talking, correct?
66 and 67. So very close. But to answer your question, I mean, and here's the thing. So I was familiar with the concept of Men in Black from the Will Smith thing and didn't really know much else about it until getting into the whole Mothman story. Now, obviously, over the years, during the Project Blue Book investigations and the different things that went on within the ufological community, the whole idea about Men in Black has been that either they're A, government agents, people who come to kind of silence UFO witnesses, paranormal witnesses, to kind of just clamp down on that type of information getting out there, so to speak. But then there's also another dimension to Men in Black, which basically is that perhaps they're paranormal themselves. And throughout John Keel's book, The Mothman Prophecies, he speaks to Men in Black being present in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, during the Mothman story, and basically being what looked like government agents, usually in dark olive skin, like maybe they were of Greek heritage or maybe Arabic heritage, not necessarily your Anglo-American type folks, but usually spoke in a different dialect, really didn't seem to even be able to get the times correct. I mean, a lot of the times they would speak in almost riddles, just very, very strange occurrences that really led people to believe that they weren't human beings.
That's interesting. So do you have any stories in particular of these guys that you've researched at this point?
Well, I think the most prominent, there are a couple of different stories in the Mothman Prophecies of different depictions of Men in Black. And the first one is the person that I, or the entity that I alluded to a little while ago, and that was Indrid Cold. And Indrid Cold has been postulated to be either the spaceman that he proved himself or spoke of himself to be, or perhaps some type of a government agent who was basically trying to do some type of disinformation within the community as things were developing in Point Pleasant. And then also that maybe he was truly some other type of spiritual entity. So the Indrid Cold story is kind of shrouded in a possible Men in Black thing. Now, another aspect of the story is there was a witness by the name of Connie Carpenter. And Connie Carpenter, I think, was about an 18-year-old young lady who saw Mothman on the way home from church one day. And she was walking to her apartment, and there was a man in a late model car, which looked like it was brand new, but it was, you know, several years old. And he had kind of motioned for her to come over to the car. And when she did, he grabbed onto her arm, tried to pull her inside of the car, basically to abduct her. And she managed to break away and was able to go back into her apartment, lock the doors. The next day, somebody had slipped a note underneath her door that said, "Be careful, we can get you yet, girl." So was another story of a possible Men in Black appearing. And then Carolyn Harris told us all about the Men in Black when we met her in her restaurant the first time we went to Point Pleasant, and said that we just thought they were government men. That's the way she described them.
So, wow. I guess the more you kind of dive into this, I mean, it's almost like this town was being harassed.
It really did seem to be. And there is a researcher who has really followed in the footsteps of John Keel by the name of Andy Colvin. And Andy has spoken to a number of different conspiracy angles with what might have been happening in Point Pleasant at the time. Now, this TNT area that we've spoken of just a little bit, that is, today it's called the McClintock Wildlife Preservation. But what the TNT area is, 11 miles north of Point Pleasant, is an area where during World War II, munitions, dynamite basically, TNT, was being manufactured, and there was a huge operation out there to be able to basically supply the United States forces with dynamite for the war effort. So that all took place and was built really right either on top of or right next to the Chief Cornstalk hunting grounds. So we also have an aspect of perhaps burial lands being violated by having war munitions being built right on top of them. Wow. So there's also an alleged curse that kind of goes along with this whole story as well.
Well, Bill, when we come back from the break, we're going to see how much more deep this rabbit hole goes. 1-833-880-9899. We'll be back. This is Radio Disclosure. Welcome back to Radio Disclosure, 1-833-880-9899. Town being harassed. They're making TNT for the war. There's theory that maybe they did this, close to burial grounds, and maybe that's why all this crazy stuff is happening. Now, Bill, I want to ask you about your wife and her role in your research. Now, I have did a little bit of, just a very tiny bit of research on you prior, and your wife seems to have some special abilities that you have not discussed in her role in your research. I'm curious on how those play into that.
Sure. Well, first off, she's a saint because she's put up with me for about 17 years. So she's got that definitely going for her. But Jackie is incredibly intuitive, and she is really insightful. She's into meditation. She's been able to, come to me to basically tell me, there was a gentleman that I kind of counseled and worked with very closely about 10 years ago who passed away sadly of cancer. Mm-hmm. And she, during a deep meditative state, told me that he had appeared to her and said, "Tell Bill I'm in a good place and thank him." And it was really, really incredibly touching. But that was one of the first instances, 10 years ago, that I realized that she had some special abilities that perhaps not everybody does. On top of that, she is a retired United States Postmaster. She finally was able to retire just a few months ago. And interestingly enough, retired one day and we took off for Point Pleasant the next. So she went straight from one professional endeavor to the next. And we took our 500-mile trek out to Point Pleasant. But she's really, like I mentioned, highly intuitive and very perceptive of a lot of things. And she's been practicing lately doing a little bit of astral travel, wherein she has been able to visualize certain things, like my desktop in my home office. She'll be in her meditation room where she has all kinds of crystals. She has a crystal shop and does all types of crafting and things of that nature. But she has been able to actually sit in the meditation room and then draw the things that are on my desktop, regardless of whether they're the same as the day before or not. And one of the interesting things that she did a few months ago when she first started doing this was she drew something on my desk, and it didn't make sense to her because it was a grid. It was, horizontal lines, vertical lines, what have you. And when she went into my office later on, that day before going out to work, I had left my laptop not only on the desk but open. So those grids were the keys. I never leave my laptop there. So she's just got all kinds of perceptive abilities. She's really good at analytical thinking, and she's been a real asset to our investigation.
Yeah, and something you mentioned before is you said that she you guys were walking together, and she said that, "I think she wants to talk to us." That's a special gift of knowing.
Yes.
So if you were to tell the audience anything you wanted to tell them about your research in Mothman that we haven't discussed yet, what would that be?
I think I would say, and honestly, in having been going through the information that we talked about during the last section of our conversation, that as we began to analyze the various aspects of the experiences that the people that we interviewed had, so many good things came from the experience. I mean, we know the bridge collapse was a horrible, horrible thing, but community development, support, trusting in others, your neighbors, so many fantastic, positive elements, personal development, the ability to take a different perspective upon life in general, spiritual enhancement, all these wonderful things happened as a result of going through this negative experience. And if we take that same concept and transpose that over into the supernatural aspect of the things that appeared for 13 months before the bridge collapse went down too, you have Andy Colvin, who was in Charleston, who also had similar experiences. He interviewed for our project too and has become a good friend of ours. He has written and published over 100 books and has built an entire business based upon some of the negativity that he experienced, the paranormal things that happened in his life. he's been able to turn that around into a really nice book business and some wonderful analytical publications that are just a lot of fun to read. So all these good things, I think, can come from experiences like this. And with the Mothman in general, I think it's really important to keep an open mind. And when people tell you they've had a strange experience, hear them out, you know, give them audience. Don't just discount it and say, you know, you're not firing on all eight cylinders. There might be something wrong with you. No, I think we've really got to give them a good listening ear and hear where they're coming from and be open to some of the things they have to share. And then to look at the good that can come out of those types of encounters as well.
Yeah. And the one thing that I was going to say about different people and different experiences is people observe things completely different from other people. And people also have other skills of observation that other people don't have. And I think your wife is one of those people. I mean, as an example, I'm sensitive in some areas, and I know people that are even more sensitive to me in different areas, but I can tell you right now that having paranormal experiences is not as bad as what a lot of people like to make it out to be, but I can also tell you that sometimes it's very eye-opening. You have these things that happen to you. Yes, it's a life-changing event, and you get an idea of that life-changing event and what it can do. So, Bill, again, hit up where people can get to you, where they can find you, your website, all that information.
Sure. You know, I can be contacted. Our group can be contacted at phenomenologyresearchpartners.com. We also have a Facebook page with the same name, Phenomenology Research Partners. I can also be found on Facebook at Bill Kousalis. And I can even be emailed at bkousalis@capellauniversity.com.
Well, Bill, I want to say thank you for joining us. We'll probably have you on again. I'll tell you, folks, the Mothman stuff, there's so many people, there's so much research, there's so much that has gone into stating that, yeah, this was a real experience, and not just, yeah, they made that up. Yeah. Anyways, if you've got something to disclose to us or want to suggest a guest, call us at 1-833-880-9899, follow the prompts, leave us a voicemail, and we'll definitely consider it. If you've definitely got something to disclose to us, call us and let us know as well. Like to say thank you to WTWW, the International Shortwave Station, for carrying us tonight, and all of our other local affiliates. This has been Radio Disclosure. Have a good night.